Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Offensive Shadows.
Your 15 minutes with Abroad, Her Bud, and the Bard.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Danny.
Here at Offensive Shadows, we're going to present Shakespeare to you in a fashion where you can find it both simple and entertaining. We're going to cover Shakespeare's career and his plays in roughly a chronological order. We'll be breaking out the War of the Roses and covering it on their own specifically. In our first few episodes, we'll be covering the lamentable tragedy of Titus Andronicus. But before we begin, let's cover some Elizabethan theater jargon. Starting off with, what's a quarto?
Well, if you picture a giant piece of paper, and then you fold it in half, and then you fold it in half again, you will have four pieces. Well, four quarters. Quarto meaning four. And then if you take a knife and sort of slit up three sides of those, you have a little booklet. That is a quarto. They were simple, they were cheap, and that is how books got mass-produced in the Elizabethan times. And when a play was published during Shakespeare's lifetime, it was published in quarto. So you'll hear people say first quarto, second quarto. It refers to an edition of any given play.
And what was the first what was the folio then?
A folio is if you go back to your giant piece of paper and you fold it in half, so it's two pages, very large, used for big books. So when they published the first folio of 1623, which is the first published edition of all of Shakespeare, well, most of Shakespeare's plays, it was in folio. The first folio is the most noteworthy folio that we're going to be talking about.
And when we're talking about pieces of paper here, we're not talking about 8.5 by 11. We're talking large sheets.
You're talking publisher sheets.
So, what's a groundling?
A groundling is a sect of the Elizabethan culture that could not afford to purchase actual seats when they went to the theater. So if you're thinking early modern England, the theater was actually a really exciting event. They didn't have movies, they didn't have other forms of entertainment, so pretty much everybody came out to see theater. And if you were, you know, Joe Bob the farmer, you could not afford to go and sit in the fancy seats, so you stood around the front of the stage and you watched theater. It was very cheap, and if you go to the Globe today, you can actually be a groundling for, I believe it's £15.
So they're poor people like us.
Yes, they are poor people like us.
Very well. What is the canon? I've heard references to the canon.
The canon is a word for any body of literature. So when we're talking about the canon, we're talking about Shakespeare's canon, Shakespeare's body of work.
So, and what was the rest of the theater like? So you had the groundlings at the in the pit or on the ground floor, sitting in the cheap seats.
Well, standing.
Standing in the cheap seats. They don't even get to sit down.
Nope. So you go to the theater in early modern England, and you're walking into a building that is round-ish. It actually has 20 sides, and if you picture a circle, the outside of the circle has sort of thatching, so there was a roofed portion, but the center of the circle was not roofed. It was left to the open air.
So the rich people got the roofing, and the groundlings got nothing?
That's absolutely correct. The groundlings were there. Rain or shine, same at the Globe in London today, by the way, so if you're going to go be a groundling, make sure it's not going to rain. Or bring a poncho. And then the stage itself, if you picture a T with the long end being the back of the stage, and then the sort of front jutting into the audience, that is what you have. It's called a three-quarter thrust. And over a portion of it, there was an awning supported by two columns downstage. And then upstage, you had two doors at the back of the stage where actors could make their entrances and exits. They could also enter and exit from the wings. And then above those doors, you had a balcony where you would get Juliet's balcony or like Cleopatra in the monument where they have to lower Antony down, that sort of thing. Then beneath that, between the two doors, you had an alcove that could be curtained over, and that's called the discovery space. And in that space, you're going to get some of the rare interiors that we find in Shakespeare. So like Desdemona's bedroom would probably be there. Then around the outside of the audience, underneath the thatching, as you noted, were raked benches, which is where the aristocracy and people who could afford to pay would sit. Now, notably, you can't actually see the stage very well from most of these places, but you can be seen. So you would go to the theater to be seen if you were of a certain set of culture.
So, was there a lot of scenery on stage? Was it, Did they have a lot in the way of props? What were the production values like?
We're talking pretty bare bones. Pretty much everything, props, that sort of thing, would be something the actors could carry on stage and off stage with them. The only really extravagant thing that they had in the Elizabethan theater were costumes, because if you were a queen or a lady or a duchess, you would, you know, wear your dress once, and then what would you do with it? Well, the answer was you would donate it to the theater so that the actors could wear it. The other thing that they had was actually live animals, because the theaters were used for bear baiting and that sort of thing on their days off, so they had live bears.
Well, really? They had live bears on stage?
They had live bears, yes.
That's awesome. So with that said, we're going to step into Titus. As I said before, this is one of Shakespeare's first plays. It's his first tragedy that we know that he wrote, and it's very bloody. It's almost Tarantino-esque in its level of violence. When exactly was it written?
Well, because of early modern publishing and copyright practices, we can't really ascertain a solid date for any of the shows. We can estimate dates based upon notations in the Stationer's Registrar, which is the closest thing to a copyright which existed in Elizabethan England, and you would go to the Stationer's office and say, I'm this guy, I wrote this play, and they would write it down. There were also contemporary allusions to the play in journals and diaries. Obviously, this is a pretty haphazard dating method, because you're depending on people to A, remember something accurately, and B, record it accurately. And then, of course, there were records of performances, but not all performances were recorded. When we talk about Shakespeare, however, we do have one fairly reliable source for recorded performances, and that's Henslowe's diary. Philip Henslowe, played by Geoffrey Rush in Shakespeare in Love, by the way, was the owner of the Rose Theater, where Shakespeare's career likely began, and where Titus was most definitely first performed. And then later he was a founding member of the Globe Theater. He was just a theater entrepreneur in Elizabethan London, and the great thing about Henslowe was that he kept a really solid record of all the things that a producer would need to know, like box office receipts, props, memos, notes, lists of money lent, etc. And this record survives till the present day, so it's a powerful dating tool for a lot of these plays. Henslowe's diary notes a performance of Titus and Andronicus on January 23rd, 1594, and it also notes that it was a new play. On February 6th of that year, the title A Noble Roman History of Titus Andronicus was entered into the Stationer's Registrar. We can firmly date the play at least as early as 1592, because he needed some time to write it before it would have gone to these two sources, but it may have even been written as early as the 1580s due to a comment made in passing. And then when the theaters were closed in 1592 and 1593, we do know that Shakespeare wrote two Roman-themed poems, The Rape of Lucretian, Venus, and Adonis, and those could have lent him inspiration for Titus, which supports the argument that he probably wrote it earlier, in like 1592-ish.
So we know roughly when the play was first brought to the stage. When do we get the first printed version?
The first quarto of Titus Andronicus was published in 1594, and it seems to derive directly from Shakespeare's manuscript. It was also published in two additional quartos and the first folio of 1692. Now, what this means notably is that it was actually quite popular because quartos were printed on demand, and since there were so many people buying it, they had to print at least three editions during Shakespeare's lifetime, which is pretty uncommon for a Shakespeare show. There is one full scene, which is the fly-killing scene in Act 4, which is introduced in the first folio version, which makes us think that Shakespeare probably added that scene for a revival of the show sometime between the first quarto in 1594 and the first folio of 1623, which means that it was performed pretty actively in the repertoire between the time when he wrote it and the time when he stopped writing.
So that's the background for the play. What were the major themes going on?
Well, the great thing about Titus is that we start to see some of these like burgeoning themes that are going to haunt us throughout the canon very early in his career. So we have the sibling rivalry theme between Bassianus and Saturninus, and then again between Chiron and Demetrius. And of course, in Elizabethan London, we see this played out on the great stage of politics with Elizabeth and Mary vying for the throne. We also see in Titus madness, and this idea of madness, of feigned or real madness, comes back to haunt us in like Hamlet and Lear and the great tragedies later on. We have the father's grief at the fate of a beloved daughter, which again, we'll see in Lear. The strong father-daughter and mother-son relationships, which we're going to see in Lear, Winter's Tale, The Tempest. And then, of course, this play is obsessed with the dismembering of bodies as a metaphor for the body politic. And that's going to come up again as well.
And with the themes of the play laid out, let's move on to Act 1. Act 1 opens up with Saturninus and Bassianus, the two sons of the dead emperor of Rome, arguing over who's going to take the throne. They both have their own posses or their own men or supporters behind them. And into this argument steps Marcus Andronicus, the brother of Titus Andronicus, the title character. Marcus announces that the people, historically likely the legions, are supporting Titus as emperor, or as a third candidate for the throne. And the two brothers, knowing that more than likely the army is supporting Titus, agree to dismiss their followers and plead their case to the Senate when Titus shows up with the army. Titus then enters the scene with a funeral procession. Titus is coming back from a 10-year war with the Goths, in which he lost 21 of his 25 sons.
And this is a nightmare to stage, as you can imagine, because how do you have a guy walk on with 21 coffins? It's one of the reasons, one of the problems that cause a lot of theater companies not to do this show.
Entering with Titus are his prisoners from the campaign, Tamora, the queen of the Goths, and her three sons, as well as Aaron the Moor.
And this is the first time that we see an individual of color in Shakespeare's canon. Now, he's actually sort of closely copying Marlowe's Tamburlaine here, who also has a bloodthirsty African character. But Aaron has a lot more behind him than Marlowe's version, which we will see as we proceed.
Yeah, I found him, while he is definitely a villain in the play, he has some pretty substantial motivations. He is not he's not a snidely whiplash, twisting the mustache type of villain.
No, he's definitely a human guy, and he is so good to hate.
So after they enter, Titus puts his sons to rest, his dead 21 sons. And in the scene, Lucius, one of his remaining sons that is still alive, calls for a sacrifice from the Goths. He asks for the eldest son of Tamora to be sacrificed to lay to rest the ghost of his brothers. Tamora pleads with Titus not to support this request, but Titus will hear nothing of it. And he authorizes Lucius to carry out Tamora's eldest son to be dismembered, specifically to have his arms and legs ripped off, and to be sacrificed to place to rest his fallen sons.
And already we have here the dismembering of the body. Act 1, Scene 1, we're already tearing people apart. Go Shakespeare.
After the sacrifice, Tamora and her remaining sons and Aaron the Moor are carried offstage and enter Lavinia.
Oh my god, Lavinia. Good God.
Possibly the most boring character in Shakespeare's canon. Lavinia comes in to welcome her father home.
She's just so boring. She doesn't do anything. Lavinia is, they call her the Jewel of Rome, and that's pretty much all she is. She's just like this pretty face that everybody wants to marry. And by the middle of the second act, you'll see there are already four men who have expressed interest in her. And granted, she's just an extension of the body politic. She's just one big metaphor. But you can tell that this is before Shakespeare had figured out how to really give his lady characters some kick, especially the sort of boring ingenue roles, because Tamora has kick, but Lavinia is the most boring character this side of Hamlet.
After Lavinia says hello to her father, there is some foreshadowing placed into the dialogue where Titus tells her that she must live past her father. Our Marcus enters with Saturninus and Bassianus again, and they've come to tell Titus that he could be emperor. Titus takes the noble step of saying no, which is actually unheard of in Roman history. Generally, when a general had the backing of the legions, he took the throne no matter who had the legal right to it.
Which just goes to show, Titus is just this good guy. I mean, he's a military general. We know that because the army backs him. But he's a noble general. He should be the true leader of Rome.
He's at least a lawful character.
Definitely.
To begin with. I wouldn't say exactly call him a good man, But he's very much he's an upstanding Roman. You know, he espouses Roman values in that he will follow the law and not seize power for himself. Titus instead says he'll choose to back Saturninus, who is the lawful ruler of Rome at this point, even though he may not necessarily have the backing of the people or the backing of the legions. Saturninus is the eldest son of the dead emperor. Saturninus then announces that he will marry Lavinia, Titus's daughter, and this will forge an alliance between the two houses. Titus agrees to the match, and he hands over his prisoners to the emperor. Saturninus, at this point, sees Tamora and says, just after he said he'd marry Lavinia, says that had he not just pledged to marry Lavinia, he would have offered poor Tamora to take her hand in marriage. Instead, he offers to just set them free. So he's just freed Titus's prisoners, from which he just had executed their relative.
This is not going to end poorly for anyone.
At the same time as Saturninus is professing his liking for Tamora, his brother, Bassianus, grabs Lavinia out from behind him, and because they're apparently in love, or at least Bassianus has had his eye on Lavinia, apparently like most men in Rome, and makes a run with it. Marcus, Titus...
Claiming that they are married.
Yes, claiming that they are married, or that they have already married. Marcus, Titus's brother, also assists in this kidnapping. In fact, all of Titus's family assists in this kidnapping. Titus himself calls for the guards when his son, Mutius, steps in front and says, "No, father, wait." Titus, being the lawful Roman, kills him immediately, his own son. Titus then disowns the rest of his family and tells Saturninus that he will get Lavinia back for him. Saturninus, perhaps feeling insulted, perhaps feeling that he now has an opportunity to back away from his engagement, says, "Don't bother, Titus. I'm going to marry Tamora instead."
Yeah, not going to end poorly for anyone, clearly. And at this point, blood's already been spilt in the first act. You know, like that minor side character of Titus's son, Mutius. Too bad, we're going to kill him. And that minor side character of Tamora's son, too bad, he's also dead. And it also proves that Titus is pretty much a badass. He just often kills one of the four sons he has left to him after the war has taken 21 of the 25. He is not a blushing flower.
So Titus is understandably upset at this point. He has just lost another son who was disobeying the emperor, and he's blaming his family for his misfortune because he just lost his alliance with the emperor as well. He tries to prevent his family from burying Mutius, the dead son in the family tomb, but Marcus, his brother, finally convinces him to allow the burial. Bassianus and Saturninus finally meet up again as Saturninus catches up to Bassianus and they trade insults. Saturninus is quite upset that Bassianus has stolen his bride, whether or not he's going to, he desires Tamora. The insult has still been laid upon him. In this dispute, Tamora steps up and acts as peacemaker. Tamora convinces Saturninus to back off because his position is not secure at this point. Titus has the legions. Bassianus has his own men. Peace, at this point, is best for him. She convinces him that they can have their revenge later. The emperor, thinking that her judgment is sound, pardons his brother and the rest of Titus's family, and the court is then invited by Titus to partake of a hunt the next day to smooth things over. And that brings us to the close of Act 1.
Holy moly, wow, what a Shakespearean first act. This is one of the few plays where he just lumps the entire first act together in one big, long scene. Later on, you'll start to see him breaking it up, but we just get this parade of people coming and going and coming and going, and it really sets up the court of Rome. We're introduced to the major characters, and we sow the seeds of the major plot arcs, and we even get foreshadowing of most of the characters' fates. Like, we mentioned the Lavinia Liv, and also when she's kidnapped, there's a whole to-do about how dare you rape her, and Bassianus is like, whoa, 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 this is not rape. This doesn't generally read to a modern audience, because rape, we generally associate with a sexual violation. If we talk about the old Latin words, the word raptus is actually about abducting someone against their will, whereas the word steprum is Latin for a sexual violation, and that'll come back later. This is also before Shakespeare figured out how to really break up his tragedies with some comedy in the middle of it, and maybe this because the violence innate in it placed the groundlings, so he didn't really feel the need to add the comedy for them. But it also might be just because he wasn't as sophisticated yet in his playwriting. In any case, when you go to see a good production of Titus, you walk out feeling like you've been run over by a truck. There is no relief here. The only clown character generally gets cut. You're just thing after thing after thing. And as a result as well, the narrative is really tight. There's no real side plot. It all kind of weaves back in more seamlessly than just about any other play in the canon.
So this actually is definitely one of his more tighter plays, and it's kind of interesting that I think it actually reads better to modern audiences, or specifically the show is better for modern audiences, because especially this first act, it's very tight, it's nonstop, it's one thing after another, whereas some of his later plays, which are a little more sophisticated and played better to the audience of the time, may not necessarily play well to our modern audiences, because he did have a different type of pacing. The first act here, and for most of the play, it's pretty much nonstop of bang, 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 one incident after another. And that wraps up Act 1. In our next episode, we will be covering Acts 2 and 3, and we'll hopefully finish up in two more episodes after that. The Act 5 is a particularly packed episode, so we may have to break that one up.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.